Tuesday until noon on Wednesday. 3 to 10 inches of snow possible. Winds gusting up to 35 miles per hour.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Objection sustained. A federal judge dismisses the criminal cases against two of Donald Trump's political rivals, saying the prosecutor who brought them forward was appointed illegally. Our guest says that win doesn't necessarily mean former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James won't be back in court again.
And friend and fellow Jamaican musician Roger Lewis remembers the late reggae legend Jimmy Cliff. Mr. Lewis says he wasn't just a great musician who brought Jamaica to the world, he was a great human being.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as Chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or Fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. And don't forget to tune in to Headwaters tomorrow. There will be a conversation with Dave Simonette in concert at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids this Saturday. Headwaters will be tomorrow from 9 to 11 a.m. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. It's a new one from Daniel Donato and Ellie King. This song is called Another Dimension.
Keep sending me down the line. Don't wanna decide, fix broken stride, see what we find. Till the rivers don't run and the sun don't shine. Till our day. Together, we share a sign. To call in my mind, this maiden flag, your dream is mine. Till the rivers don't run and the sun won't shine. Till our day.
Again, that's Daniel Donato and Ellie King with the song Another Dimension.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
an open and shut and possibly reopened case. A U.S. federal judge dismisses the criminal cases against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. But a former U.S. attorney tells us this may not be their last day in court.
Generative to a fault. The editor of a Toronto magazine tells us he was ready to take a chance on an ambitious young writer, but the more he dug into her work, the more it seemed like she'd had help from AI.
The king of Kingston, the late Jimmy Cliff, helped bring reggae to the world. Roger Lewis of the group Inner Circle reflects on the incredible cultural impact his friend had.
Not the kind of issues they're used to dealing with. An American magazine giant is facing tough questions after firing four employees who tried to ask management some tough questions of their own.
It's not tongue-in-cheek, it's tongue without cheek. If you worry about food that scorches your mouth, you may benefit from a new synthetic tongue that can determine the exact spiciness level beforehand.
And disappearing into thin hair. Conchologists and citizen scientists have joined forces in London, England to track down and save the endangered German hairy snail. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that's in hot hirsute. Today, a judge dismissed the criminal cases against James Comey and Letitia James, and in doing so, issued a rebuke to Donald Trump's Justice Department. In the ruling, the judge called the appointment of Lindsay Halligan, the interim U.S. attorney who brought the indictments against Mr. Comey and Ms. James, unlawful. You'll remember that Mr. Comey, the ex-FBI director, had been facing charges for making false statements to Congress. The case against Ms. James, New York's attorney general, was related to mortgage fraud. They had both denied the allegations. This afternoon, James Comey issued a video statement.
This case mattered to me personally, obviously, but it matters most because a message has to be sent that the President of the United States cannot use the Department of Justice to target his political enemies. I don't care what your politics are, you have to see that as fundamentally un-American and a threat to the rule of law that keeps all of us free. I know that Donald Trump will probably come after me again, and my attitude is going to be the same. I'm innocent, I am not afraid, and I believe in an independent federal judiciary. The gift from our founders that protects us from a would-be tyrant.
Barbara McQuaid is a law professor and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. We reached her in Ann Arbor.
Barbara, of all of the paths to victory here for Comey and James, is this the best possible outcome that they might have expected, that you were expecting?
Well, it is for now. The cases are both dismissed, and until further notice, they are just free to go. The only downside, I suppose, from the perspective of Comey and James, is that these cases can be refiled. They were dismissed without prejudice because of the unlawful appointment of Lindsay Halligan, the interim U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. And so I imagine if the government wants to, they could figure out a lawful way to either appoint her or someone else to this position and then have them proceed with a new indictment. Even though the Comey indictment has passed its statute of limitations, there is another statute that says that if an indictment is dismissed, the government has another 6 months to sort of cure that indictment by refiling. So it would not surprise me if the government did not try to obtain new indictments against both of these defendants.
And James Comey, clearly, as we heard there, would not be surprised if, as he put it, the Donald Trump would come after me again. A White House spokesperson saying this afternoon, quote, "The facts of the indictments against Comey and James have not changed, and this will not be the final word on this matter," unquote. There could be those kinds of statements, but ultimately, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that Donald Trump and his team have done what they wanted to do overall and will retreat?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, it's hard to ever predict what the Trump administration is going to do. They tend not to retreat, but they often do engage in spin. I think one of the things that has been exposed since both of these cases has been filed is, in light of the tremendous media attention they've both received, I think it has really been exposed just how weak both of these cases are. I think both of these cases on their merits are very likely to end up in acquittals. And so it may be that the government reassesses its best strategy is to sort of cut bait now. And, you know, they can blame some Democratic president-appointed judge for their woes and be on their way. Because after all, you may recall that the head of the weaponization working group at the Justice Department is a man named Ed Martin. And Ed Martin said that the goal is to name and shame people even when the evidence is not sufficient to obtain a conviction. So maybe they will assess that they've already inflicted enough pain and they can be on their way to other targets.
I mean, as someone who works in the system, just what you said there, even though it's been out there before, I think would be striking to a lot of people, whether they work in that system or not, whether there's enough to take this to trial or not. That's extraordinary.
It's absolutely chilling. It really is, because the Justice Department is governed by policies called the Principles of Federal Prosecution. And what those policies say is that a prosecution should not be brought unless the prosecutor is convinced that it's likely that the evidence is sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction. You know, no case is a slam dunk, no case is perfect, and so, you know, sometimes you lose, but you have to believe that the evidence is very strong and that you are very likely to win. To bring a case, even when you think it's insufficient, just to name and shame someone, is unethical, and it's an abuse of those principles of federal prosecution.
So ultimately, the message from this court and this judge, what message does it send to the Justice Department?
Moment, I think this is a victory for the rule of law, because what it says is the president cannot circumvent the constitutional advice and consent role of the Senate to make sure that only qualified people end up in these roles as U.S. attorneys. And that's what they attempted to do here, to appoint Lindsey Halligan, who seems incredibly unqualified, having never been a prosecutor. And after already following another appointee who resigned rather than bring these charges. And so what it says is they're going to have to bring somebody either who is appointed by the court or who is Senate confirmed. And perhaps that person who is qualified and who does have experience and maybe some ethics will decide not to bring this case again.
Do you think that under this administration and everything you've said so far, that it will have a meaningful long-term impact on this Justice Department right now and how it's operating?
I hope so. I mean, I think every time truth is spoken and then there's some pushback against an abuse, I think it makes it a little harder for abuse to occur in the future. I think it exposes abuse, which I think can make things more politically difficult the next time as well, when the public believes that somebody has been charged in violation of the law. As you heard in that statement from Jim Comey there, regardless of your politics, everybody should be bothered by this concept that the president is going after his political enemies. And so I think, you know, the president's power got knocked down just a couple of pegs today, and I think that's probably a good thing.
Do you think that ultimately this was a miscalculation by the administration?
I do. I think that they miscalculated it on the merits, and I also think that their procedural overreach was something that they maybe miscalculated. Although it seems that in some ways, there's really no downside to losing. If you assert power and you achieve it, then you've just achieved more power. If you assert power and you don't achieve it, then nothing ventured, nothing gained, I suppose. Right. I imagine we'll see more of these efforts to extend executive power, as we have seen before in this administration. But I think it's so important that other branches of government push back and serve as a check on those overreaches of power.
Barbara, I appreciate this as always. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and a professor of law at the University of Michigan. We reached her in Ann Arbor. The New Yorker is in the midst of celebrating its 100th birthday, as it should. It's an institution that's won 11 Pulitzer Prizes, been a trailblazer in long-form journalism, and published short fiction for many of the world's best writers. But while those festivities are unfolding, so is a controversy that affects not just the New Yorker, but all of American media company Condé Nast's publishing empire. Trouble has been brewing for a while, but it came to a head earlier this month when management announced that Teen Vogue would be folded into Vogue.com and laid off six of its editorial staffers. Condé Nast employees had questions about that, and when they couldn't get answers, they took their questions to the office of human resources head Stan Duncan.
So everyone, we'd appreciate if you would go back to the workplace where you're...
Is there a place that you would be able to speak to us?
Not today. We have other things going on.
Do you think we're not worth speaking to, Sam?
Those are your words, not mine.
But they might be your beliefs.
They're not my beliefs.
Oh, okay. So you do think we're worth speaking to.
Everyone should go back to your workplace.
I work here.
You told us that we have to come work in person here 4 days a week. This is our workplace now. Yeah, are you running away from us?
No, I'm directing you back to your place.
Part of a video showing a confrontation between a number of Condé Nast employees and the company's head of human resources. In the wake of that interaction, four staffers were fired. Their dismissals have led to an outpouring of support, including from high-profile New Yorker contributors like Susan Orlean, Calvin Trillin, and Patrick Radden Keefe, from New York Attorney General Letitia James, and from their unions, which share a parent union with CBC employees. Jake LaHut is a former White House reporter for Wired magazine and one of the four people who were fired. We reached him in Claverack, New York.
Jake, you were part of that group outside Stan Duncan's office earlier this month. Why did you want to be there in person that day?
I wanted to be there, one, just to stand up for my colleagues. I think if I've learned anything in covering Trump 2.0, it's that there's never been a more important time to stand up for people where you can. In my experience at Wired, Condé Nast had no say or interference of any sort in our political coverage, which, you know, our coverage of the Trump administration was quite aggressive, and we had a lot of scoops about Doge, and I had a lot of stories about the role of Elon Musk and other tech billionaires that I'm still very proud of. But the shuttering of Teen Vogue was definitely a big motivator for a lot of people there. And, you know, I shared in that. I think we need more perspectives and more viewpoints covering politics in the U.S., especially, you know, there's a burgeoning conservative media ecosystem. I think that just what the publication stood for and the way it was looking out for topics that younger people cared about and framing stories in a way that a lot of other outlets didn't or weren't willing to, I thought was very admirable.
Political stories.
Yeah, more just frankly, like, I think what they're most known for, if you're on social media, was just aggressive, you know, headlines about Trump world and, you know, various figures that didn't pull any punches.
So raising these issues, visiting the head of HR in that way at his office, did you have any qualms about that? Did you think this is different than sending a memo? This might be crossing a line. This could get me in trouble.
This was my first ever, march on the boss, as you call it in union parlance, which is, you know, protected under U.S. labor law to assemble and ask, you know, and demand some answers from management. I was really there as a learning experience to see just, you know, as someone who really cares a lot about institutional knowledge and history, like, how might this go? What works in this setting? What doesn't? You know, our expectation was just that management hadn't been willing to meet about these layoffs. And I think, you know, we were at the very least owed kind of a rationale or the promise of, you know, a future sit down or something.
And you were in your probationary period with the company. How did you weigh that before you decided to take part?
To be honest, I did not consider that at all. And I, you know, if there had been in my mind, you know, a 1% chance that I could get fired for something like that. And, you know, in a probationary period, they don't even need cause to fire you. But I was very much under the belief that this was protected labor activity and didn't think I would be fired. But once I did know I was fired, which happened when Condé Nast canceled a TV appearance I was scheduled to go on that night, and I started putting some pieces together, I did think of that.
And just to go back to what you said, you didn't get a notice that you were being fired. You were supposed to do a television interview, and they called you to say, why did you cancel our television interview?
Yeah. And then I realized I couldn't log into Slack or my work email. Eventually, there was a group chat of all four of us in the union notified by someone with the guild to tell us that management had just informed them that we were all being terminated. And then I eventually got an email putting it in writing that I was somehow engaging in gross misconduct, was the terminology they used.
We reached out to Condé Nast, of course. A spokesperson sent us a version of the same statement that you may have seen elsewhere. It reads in part, quote, "We cannot ignore behavior that crosses the line into targeted harassment and disruption of business operations," unquote. Did you see or do anything that crossed a line?
The only thing I said was what was intended as kind of a lighthearted and de-escalatory joke when Mr. Duncan had come in kind of hot after, I would add, there had been a woman at the door who was handling things very, very cordially and totally fine beforehand. He said, "You can't congregate here." And I said, "Well, what's your definition of congregating?" The company has not provided me with any policy that I violated. I think I'm a reporter. This is what they brought me here to do, is to ask hard questions. And when it comes to standing up for my colleagues, you know, I think that we deserve to ask management questions if they're not willing to meet with us otherwise.
We're speaking with you now in part because there has been quite a backlash to your firing, along with the firings of your Condé Nast colleagues, Jasper Lowe from The New Yorker, Alma Avaye from Bon Appetit, and Ben Dewey from Condé Nast as well. What do you make of the reaction?
I've been pretty surprised and genuinely heartened by it. I mean, it feels like everyone I've ever worked with in journalism and then some has reached out to me, and I'm very grateful for that. I think that this kind of shows how the company's strategy really backfired, because they really galvanized the union. And I think that, you know, I was very much in the camp where I was kind of sometimes on the fence about, like, going to meetings. And I think that what this has shown is that when we stand up for each other, you know, it's something that doesn't fade away in a day or two like I thought it might have. You know, it is weird to get this level of attention, because I've always just considered myself, like, you know, a working man's reporter. But I think I have a great support system. I'm in some good talks about jobs. And I'm working on a profile about a notable politician I've broken news on before that I'm very excited about to keep working on over the holidays.
So you have other work. Can you imagine ever working for Condé Nast again?
Oh, well, you know, I love my team at Wired so much that I would not hesitate to say yes, I would. Given how they've communicated it so far, I'm not sure if I'd ever feel truly safe. And maybe that's something that could change. I always loved The New Yorker when I was a kid. So, you know, I'll still be reading the properties. And I support my team at Wired 100%. I love all those people.
Really great to speak with you. Thank you for this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jake LaHut was fired from Wired magazine this month. We reached him in Claverack, New York. Just before Bob Marley, there was Jimmy Cliff. In fact, the story goes that Mr. Cliff accompanied a teenage Bob Marley to an audition in the early 60s. Mr. Cliff was there at the birth of modern Jamaican music, and he helped spread it around the world, especially with The Harder They Come, a movie that skyrocketed him and reggae to fame. But before all that, Mr. Cliff wrote Wonderful World, Beautiful People, an optimistic song that he told our former host Carol Off was inspired by what was going on in Jamaica in the 60s.
We were coming out of a time of a British style of politics, and into what we call socialism, okay? Socialism and all of that. So it was at that period of time. And I just felt there was conflict with both of these ideologies. And so I just decided, inspired to say, you know, what is essentially that we really want is a wonderful world with beautiful people. And that's how that song was inspired. So that was the situation of the time in Jamaica.
Jimmy Cliff speaking with former As It Happens host Karoloff in 2009. The legend of Jamaican music has died at the age of 81. Roger Lewis is a founding member of the reggae band Inner Circle. We reached him in Miami.
Roger Lewis, wonderful world, beautiful people. It's a simple but powerful sentiment, a powerful song, certainly. What is it like to hear Jimmy Cliff talking about that song?
You know, it can touch me kind of. We and Jimmy have a million conversations over the last 5 years, you know, because he moved to Miami and we were very close with him, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ironic thing about that was one of my favorite songs as a young man. Coming up, we used to play it when we used to play top 40 music in all the school bands. You know, take a look at the world and the state that it's in today. I am sure you'll agree it'll make it a better way. Instead of fussing and fighting, well, that was Jimmy, you know? Oh. And he was never afraid to, you know, tell the world in his music and in his thinking, you know?
Yeah. And so, I mean, to love somebody's music and then play their music in high school, and then to meet him, what was that like? When did you meet?
I think it was in the 70s when Jacob was alive, and Jacob was the first one. Everybody, you know, in Jamaica knew who Jimmy Cliff was, you know? And he was the vanguard along with the first wave of reggae stars that broke out on the British charts, you know, Baba and Marcia, et cetera. And, you know, Jimmy was the big man. And then we had the movie, Harder They Come.
Yeah, 1972. You
know? At that time, Jimmy was mostly living abroad. I think England or France, I'm not really sure. Mm. But and then he would come home periodically. And I remember down in Montego Bay, I was doing a show, and he was very impressed with Jacob. And he first met with Jacob, and then Jacob bring him on. That's the first time we met the great Jimmy Cliff. And he, incidentally, he's from Montego Bay, born and grown.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's scary to meet people you idolize. Sometimes, you know, you hear people say, don't meet your idols. This went well. You know, what do you remember about that first meeting?
No, I don't fully recall it, but I remember it was in Charles Square in Montego Bay, and he was backstage, and Jacob did bring him over. I remember kind of, you know, but remember, you know, it was a long time ago. Well, yeah. 50 years, that was a long time ago, man. But, you know, in the last 5 years of him moving to Miami and living in Miami, and then we got really close, and he would come to the studio periodically. The last musical things he did and recordings was really done at our studio here. And, you know, he used to bring up musicians, Dwight Richards, and you know, there's many photos we have with Jimmy, you know, like holding in the professor holding school for Jay Boog, for Peter Heritage, Graham Stem, and all these people. Everybody's come to Kimani, Marley, everybody sit, and Jimmy was, yeah, that's my fondest memories over the last 5 years. I remember him telling us the stories of how he wrote Many Rivers to Cross and the White Cliffs of Dover, and he went over to France, etc. And I remember him telling me that he was good friends with Jimi Hendrix. And I said, what, Jimmy? And, you know, and I used to beg him all the time. I said, Jimmy, I want you to record these stories you tell us, just like in your own voice. Don't make somebody write it down. Because he was so passionate, and the vibes and the feeling. Great human being, man. More than a great human being. I said, Jimmy, you're the walking foundation encyclopedia of reggae, because take us back from to the beginning. I remember them times that we're not even born yet. A great storyteller and a great man. It's so much so, I must go back again to say, I used to beg him. I said, Jimmy, man, put them things upon a recording. You recorded this story in your own words, man.
Yeah.
You know, it was a shock. More than a shock to me this morning, you know.
I'm so sorry for your loss, Roger. You know, you mentioned,
As I said before, millions and millions of people in the world who know Jimmy Cliff and his music.
They sure
you know,
do.
That was truly a solid Jamaican icon and a solid musician. And singer and philosopher, because Jimmy always put good message in his songs, you know, and thought behind it. And remember, he had songs like Vietnam, Harder They Come, looking out for the small man, and the movie itself, a backdrop of his life.
And that movie came out in 1972, The Harder They Come, as you said. For a lot of people, I mean, reggae is so much a part of our lives, well, many of us anyway, but that was the first time that, you know, a lot of people were being exposed. Can't believe it took that long, but that was the first time a lot of people were being exposed to the genre. You went on to make incredibly iconic music as well. I can't count the number of times I've danced to Sweat throughout my, you know, high school, university, all of that. Bad Boys, of course, people remember. Do you feel...
Yeah, well, you know, we were lucky to have two songs, reggae songs that the world sing, you know, so we really... happy for that.
Do you feel that Jimmy Cliff opened those doors for you or paved the way for a broader...
Without a doubt. Jimmy, Bob and the Bob Mas. Remember, you know, 1971.
Yeah.
In 1971, and just, as I said, coming out of high school, we did stuff with Bob Marley in Jamaica, most of 1971, many shows with him. Ending up on playing on his album, and he kept one song, Stir It Up, that was Inner Circle playing on Bob Marley Catch a Fire album.
Is there, I mean, it's an incredible catalog. Everyone has their favorites, I'm sure. But do you have a favorite Jimmy Cliff song?
Wonderful World and Harder They Come, man.
Yeah.
Wonderful World and Harder They Come. Harder They, you know what I mean? That's Jimmy's life, man. Harder They Come, the Harder They Fall. Yeah, that's for me.
Roger Lewis, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I'm so sorry for your loss, but thank you. These are incredible stories.
One blessed love, Mr. Neil. Nice speaking to you.
Thank you.
Without a doubt.
Thank you. Please take care.
Yeah, you too.
Roger Lewis is a founding member of the band Inner Circle. He's in Miami. Cliff with The Harder They Come.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return,
a team of scientists and volunteers in London, England, are on the slimy trail of the elusive German hairy snail. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Keep on fighting for the things I want. Though I know that when you're dead, you can't. But I'd rather be a free man in my grave.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ the DJ. That'll be from 7 to 10. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out on Thursdays. And we receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
Newsrooms around the world right now aren't just covering AI. They're struggling with how to deal with it. And for good reason. Generative AI programs like ChatGPT are shaking most fields up, journalism very much included. For Nicholas Hune-Brown from the online magazine The Local, it stopped being just a topic of conversation the moment a pitch from a writer who called herself Victoria Goldie landed in his inbox. She had bylines in big publications like The Cut, The Guardian, Architectural Digest, and her story pitch on healthcare privatization piqued Mr. Hune-Brown's interest. But then he started digging into her old work, and things got complicated. Nicholas Hune-Brown is the executive editor of The Local magazine. He's in Toronto.
Nicholas, when a pitch like this lands in your inbox, you know, response to a call you put out, what's the usual vetting process?
We read through them all, and we kind of see which ones have an original angle, see which writers have experience and have worked in places before, and then I kind of bring them all to the team and we discuss them.
So this one from Victoria Goldie was one that you were discussing. Their spidey sense, the journalistic spidey sense, starts tingling, as I understand it, and you sense some red flags. What were they?
Yeah, the first thing was it stood out because we thought it was good. It had a whole bunch of reporting already done. She said she'd spoken to regular Canadians, plus some prominent doctors here in Toronto. When I Googled her, she had all these bylines at a bunch of international publications. So that was, it stood out in that way. And the red flags were, just as I was thinking about a little bit more, is how had she done all of those interviews already without a pitch landing, without any guarantee that she was going to actually write the article. So I thought, oh, did she really phone 5 different people? When in her pitch, she said that she already had written for The Globe and Mail and The Walrus Magazine and Maisonneuve. When I Googled those publications with her name, nothing came up. She said she'd spoken to a local prominent Toronto doctor, Dr. Danielle Martin. We actually know her, so I got my colleague to email her, and she said she had never heard of this person.
And how did editors, as well as the experts she claimed to have contacted, how did they respond when you started calling them up and tried to verify what you were being told?
Yeah, so the first thing was we thought this pitch is false, and that's, you know, serious but not the biggest thing. But I kept wondering, like, what about all those publications she has in The Guardian and The Cut and New York Magazine and Dwell? And out of curiosity, I started poking around a bit there and looking at some of those pieces which quote prominent designers, professors, and so on. And I just reached out to some of those people to see if she'd actually spoken to them. And I got a bunch of different responses.
Yeah, I was reading your piece, and some of them were, you know, as you might expect, no, I didn't say that. I never spoke with them, and I don't know what's going on. But there was at least one who said, that sounds like me. I didn't, but that sounds like me, and I'm okay with it. Did that startle you?
That absolutely startled me. At that point, I thought it was kind of making me lose my mind. There's something uncanny about the whole thing, which even the people I spoke to who said, like, no, that's not me, I'm appalled by this, they also said, but what's weird is that it sounds like me. Because if we assume these articles were created using generative AI, what's probably happened is, you know, they've looked around the internet, they find people who are interested in that subject, and they say the kind of things they might say. So that was eerie to a lot of people. But I think counting on an editor's ability to spot AI writing going forward is just not going to work. These things are getting better. And, you know, kind of we like to pride ourselves that, oh, I can spot a human and I won't be fooled by AI. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case. There were a few red flags here, but yeah.
That wasn't it. Those weren't the biggest ones.
Yeah.
We did try, our producer did try to get in touch with Victoria Goldie as well for comment before we were speaking with you. We have not heard back at this point, at the time of our conversation. You were able to get in touch. That was fraught as well. Just tell our listeners how that call went.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this is the person whose byline is Victoria Goldie. I do not know their real name, and I don't know anything about them, really. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a lot of questions. Are they even a person? Are they just a name and, you know, attached to a content farm? So I set up a Google Meet call with them. In the last minute, they said they wanted to do it just audio. got them on the line, to my ear, they sounded like a young woman with an African accent. And there's some evidence from my reporting that she may be based in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. I kind of asked where she was in Toronto. She said Bloor, and that was about it. And
just Bloor.
Just Bloor, yeah, which is, you know, I didn't press on that, but it was, you know, it's the second street that comes up when you Google Toronto streets. I kind of casually asked her about some of the inconsistencies. Did you actually speak to Dr. Danielle Martin? Because she doesn't remember speaking with you. And she said, oh, that was my personal assistant who did that.
Which I don't know many freelancers that have a personal assistant.
Sure. Yeah, that's not really a thing in the freelance writing world, unfortunately. And when I confronted her with some of the bigger lies about the quotes that she had made up and were falsely attributed to real people, that's when she hung up after about 5 minutes. Mm. And I was not able to get in touch with her since. She hasn't responded to my emails.
And what does it suggest to you about the state of the freelance world, not just the rise of AI and it being used in this way, but in terms of what freelancers are doing?
It's kind of just a devastating indictment of like journalism in general. I think this kind of fraud is only possible in like a media environment that has been decimated, that doesn't have fact checkers, where editors are too busy, where we've been publishing kind of like content that is pretty indistinguishable from what someone can create using ChatGPT. It makes me pretty bummed about that. And in terms of freelancing, I think it's particularly depressing. Like my career is built as a freelance writer. At the local, we want to work with new writers. That's like part of our mandate. We want to work with people who maybe don't have a million bylines, who we haven't worked with before. And the key to doing that was believing that like a great pitch is an indication of someone's ability to tell great journalism. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. Yeah. Or I know it's not necessarily true anymore. So
yeah, I think you may be right about that. We should mention, after you reached out to several of these publications, as you tried to dig into this, they took down the stories that they, and we're talking about The Guardian, the Journal of the Law Society of Scotland as well.
Yeah, Dwell and Outrider. Yeah. My theory is they are a real person. My theory is that they live likely in Nigeria. And you can see early writing for ChatGPT. And one of the pieces, you can read, the writing is less fluid. There's some weird grammatical stuff. But it seems to be representing like the real thoughts and feelings of a real human being. Mm-hmm. And one piece I found is kind of about going online, about making you feel depressed as you see everyone who is doing better than you, about how everyone only puts up kind of a fraudulent fake persona online, and about how, you know, the person writing is just kind of tired and desperate to be productive.
What are you going to do differently to go through pitches that come in from here on in?
We are tightening up our fact-checking even more. I guess what I'm most worried about is at the front end. I think, as I mentioned before, like, how do you bring in new writers you have not worked before? We do not want to just retreat so that we're only working with the same four people who we can trust and who we know are not AI. So how to do that is still an open question, and it's something we're actively talking about right now.
I'm really glad we could speak, Nicholas. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nicholas Hune-Brown is the executive editor of The Local magazine. He's in Toronto. For the first time, the man whose leaked memo plunged the BBC into chaos is telling his side of the story. Former journalist and editorial advisor Michael Prescott raised concerns about a documentary that had spliced three quotes from a speech Donald Trump gave on January 6, 2021, making it appear that he had directly urged his supporters to storm the U.S. Capitol. The BBC apologized, but that hasn't stopped the U.S. president from threatening to sue for $1 billion. And today the BBC's senior leadership were grilled by British lawmakers over the public broadcaster's editorial standards. Mr. Prescott was also there, and he gave his opinion on what he thinks should have happened, an equally aggressive documentary on Kamala Harris.
I watched the show, okay, and even after watching it, although I thought, oh, a lot more anti-Trump witnesses than pro-Trump and so on, I thought it was a bit of an anti-Trump program. Didn't think it was fair balance, as you might expect typically from the BBC. But even then, I wasn't too alarmed, because I just thought, oh, and by the way, I rather enjoyed the program. But I thought, oh, well, they'll probably be doing just as aggressive a look at Kamala Harris next week. That's why this was so aggressive on Trump. And there wasn't a balancing program. And so at the I can't remember now. I'd need to check whether I emailed David Grossman or raised it at the next committee meeting. But I simply said, could David have a look at the show to see what... Because I could have been wrong, you know, that actually it was in line with the standards and it was all fair enough. And so that's how it wound up being looked at.
It has occurred to you, though, has it not, that Kamala Harris wasn't found by the January 6th committee to have played an active role in the Capitol riots?
Absolutely, yeah. But
so what would such a documentary look like as a companion to the Donald Trump?
Well, the Trump panorama was looking at his history as a... Obviously, he'd been president once already. His track record as a politician and purported to be trying to look at the secret of his appeal. Mm-hmm. And then thirdly, trying to look at what might the consequences be of him winning. You know, if he'd lost, he might have faced more lawsuits. If he won, he could crush them. You know, it's that sort of thing. So an equivalent look at Kamala Harris might be, well, what is the secret of her? What is her track record? What is the secret of her political appeal? What would the consequences be if she won? So it's pretty straight up and down, really. Or to me, it seems so.
Do you agree with Donald Trump's assertion that his reputation has been damaged by this documentary, considering, of course, that he was found to be a central figure in this insurrection, considering that he has been found by a civil court as being liable for sexual assault, that he's regularly boasted about sexual assault? Do you agree with Donald Trump that this documentary has harmed his image in some way?
If I could answer in two parts, as it were. Firstly, I'm supposing, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I should probably restrain myself a little bit, given that there is a potentially legal action. All I can say is I can't think of anything I agree with Donald Trump on.
That was former BBC editorial advisor Michael Prescott being questioned by Liberal Democrat MP Cameron Thomas in the House of Commons today. The chase is on. The extremely slow chase is on. Right now, more than 100 people across London, England, are searching for the German hairy snail. And when they find one, they'll know it's a German hairy snail. They'll know it's a hairy snail. They'll just guess that it's German. The survey effort is led by a rewilding organization called Citizen Zoo and the Zoological Society of London in the hopes of better understanding the endangered mollusks. Elliot Newton is the director of rewilding at Citizen Zoo. We reached him in London.
Elliot, any luck when you were out there today?
Oh, yes. Well, we had a great morning today out looking for German hairy snails. Luckily, we did find a few.
How many exactly?
Yeah, so we well, good question. So today we were doing a bit of it was more of a survey for sort of showing people how we were doing it. We actually found 8 in total today, which is quite good. But it wasn't our more formal standardized survey because we were just sort of showing people.
And so, what is the methodology? Because you're not haphazard about it. There's a strategy. What did you tell the folks that were gathered today?
Yeah, because I think it's so important because this is our German hairy snail, the sort of the subject of our really exciting citizen science-led project is a species that has been very under-recorded historically. It's a species that many people haven't even heard of, let alone looked for. So what we've been doing, we've come up with our own methodology, working with a great organisation called the Conchological Society of Great Britain and Ireland, and we've put together basically it's a one-hour survey where we use things called quadrats, and quadrats are effectively sort of squares that we put out in an environmental space, and we have a certain number of volunteers who do a timed search for 10 minutes in each of those quadrats, and each of the sites that we look at has 5 different timed searches, so 50 minutes of looking for German hairy snails in total.
I've taken a look at a photograph, and it wasn't as I imagined. When we hear hairy snail, I imagine it to be fuzzier. There are hairs, but it looked sandier, sand-covered, or encased. To me, describe for our listeners what you see when you're looking at a German hairy snail.
snails, like many species, are quite overlooked and not really, you know, we don't really spend a lot of time staring at them, which, you know, we see them more as a pest or something. But I think what's amazing with this project is that we're actually spending time to look at these under, we use a hand lens, which is a bit like a magnifying glass, and really having a look at the intricate details. And I think with any, with this is something that is true for all species. The more you look at it, the more beautiful they become. So if you look at them, they have these amazing whorls that go around, but they have on the outer sort of layer of their shell, they have these small little straight hairs that they're very small. The actual snail itself is about the size of a pea, so it's really small animals, but they're coated with this lovely little fuzz, and we think that has some traits that helps to enable them to survive in the environments that they're found.
In what way?
So because they're typically associated with our sort of riverine system, so right on the edge of riverbanks and rivers, sometimes in tidal areas where the water is going in and out with the tides. And that's quite a challenging place for an animal to live, right? Because you've got the water going in and out and you can get, you know, washed away. So what we think, and this is still sort of a working hypothesis, but our opinion is based on observation and some physiology, is that these hairs actually help to evaporate moisture. And that moisture then, because that moisture is evaporated from the mucus, so that the secreted from the foot of the snail, it means it's got really sticky mucus. So when the water is coming in and going out, it can stick to bits like wood and stuff like that, so it doesn't get pulled away with the tide. So we think that's why they're hairy.
And where does the German part come in?
Yeah, well, this is potentially even more fascinating, you know, because, you know, the UK, England, is sometimes we think of it as like an island nation, and we forget, if we went back to the last ice age, England was connected to mainland Europe, part of a wider sort of, you know, continental expanse. And back then, the Thames itself, which is the main river that's obviously flowing through London, was effectively a tributary of a wider European river system, part of the Rhine that goes through Germany. So even though, again, this is a slight hypothesis, because our earliest fossil records of this snail goes back to the Neolithic, the Stone Age type period. But we think that this is a remnant, a pre-glacial, a post-glacial remnant of what ecosystems of when the United Kingdom was attached to mainland Europe. So they're called German hairy snails because of their affiliation with the Rhine and Germany, where they're also still found today.
They are endangered in Germany and Austria as well, though. How did it get to that point there?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, well, so many of us, that's, again, a common tale for so many of our species that are, you know, driven to extinction or endangerment because we're just not appropriately looking after our ecosystems. We must remember biodiversity is our life support system. We sometimes forget how important it is for the, you know, even us as humans to exist. And I think what we've not treated our rivers in the way that we should. We've like over-engineered them. We've sort of, you know, where they should meander, and, you know, they should be these amazing meandering water bodies that flow with fast bits and slow bits. There's this amazing word called sinuosity, and that means the variety of flow that you have in a river. And we've sort of destroyed that in many ways. We've engineered our rivers, taking out that biodiversity, and as a product of that, a lot of the species that depend on our river systems are in decline too.
I like that word, sinuosity. Thank you for introducing many of us to it. You know, we've had a lot of conversations on our show here and As It Happens about efforts in and around the Thames, you know, a mudlarker who scavenges for treasure in the mud as tours, I'm not mistaken. We spoke to the woman who is helping head up the Wet Wipe Island cleanup excavation in the Thames as well. What is it about this river in particular that inspires such messy quests, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's a fascinating river. So the Thames itself is a 215-mile river that goes through the heart of London. And it has, because it's seen, you know, so much in industrialization and history. You know, when the Romans first came to London, 2,000 years ago, when it was Londinium, it would have been this amazing sprawling wetland with marshes full of beavers and eels and, you know, seahorses, actually, which still exist on the Thames to this day. But, you know, so much of the river has been sort of, you know, manipulated and changed as London became more and more industrialized. But it is the living heart. London wouldn't be there without the Thames. It is fundamentally the reason why London is there in the first place. It can reveal so many of London's secrets, and not only from what we're interested in was the ecology and the biodiversity, but so much of our social history too.
A pleasure speaking with you, Elliot. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Elliot Newton is the director of rewilding at Citizen Zoo. We reached him in London, England. It's one of life's great conundrums, how to know if something is too spicy for you before you even taste it. Some of us can gobble a handful of ghost peppers like pretzels. Others find actual pretzels a bit too spicy for our delicate tummies. But what can you do? There's no way for me to know, for example, if this pepper on this plate in front of me marked consume at your own risk is appropriate for my particular palate. All I can do is lower the whole thing into my mouth. Wait a second. Sorry, the control room's telling me something. Oh, okay. Oh, it seems a team of scientists in China have invented an artificial tongue that can determine a food's level of spiciness. The researchers write that the device, a rectangular slab of gel, was, quote, inspired by the spicy neutralizing effect of milk, unquote. The gel contains milk powder, which reacts with heat-making capsaicin in immeasurable ways. They say that this fancy robo-tongue could have a number of food industry applications and might spare a lot of human taste buds. This breakthrough may mean that one day everyone in a restaurant will be able to take out their artificial tongues and test the spice levels of their meals before making a mistake. Phenomenal stuff. But until that day, we'll have to go with our guts. Something tells me that even though it's actually, it's actually physically hot to the touch, that my iron gut will have no problem with this pepper. Delicious. My tummy. Here's Ralph with Scary Hot.
Pitch dark, so you can't see me blushing. Heart to heart, I ask you if you're crushing. You said that you would never date a diva, but turns out you like the taste of Libra. Ooh, my body was cold till you came out of the blue. Now I can't get enough of you. Window steaming up in the parking lot. Body rock, giving me a buzz when you hit the spot. Soda pop, whenever we touch, it's like, oh my God, never stop. You and I are scary high, we're scary high. Pillow talk, I wanna get to know ya. Surround me like a boa. My ex said that I don't got enough libido, but you got me going like a speedboat. Ooh, my body was cold till you came out of the blue.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.